Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Free Exchange from CapEx. I'm Oliver Wiseman, CapEx's deputy editor. Oliver Letwin has been at the heart of conservative politics for most of his adult life. From working in Margaret Thatcher's Downing Street policy unit to serving as one of David Cameron's most trusted ministers, he's played an important part in shaping the modern Conservative Party. He's also just published Hearts and Minds, a memoir in which he does more than just rattle off a series of anecdotes from a life in politics. Instead, he uses the book to make the case for the liberal, pro-market variety of conservatism that he believes is both the recipe for electoral success and makes for good government. For this week's episode of Free Exchange, I met Sir Oliver in his parliamentary office, where we discussed his book, his wide-ranging career, the roots of Tory modernisation, and why he is intensely relaxed about the Brexit negotiations.
Well, can we start by talking about Keith Joseph?
Yep.
He was your first sort of real boss in politics.
Yep.
And something of a hero of yours, would that be a fair
Yes, I think that's a fair description. I mean, he was... He was an immensely engaging and remarkable man with, like all the rest of us, many flaws, which were amongst his most engaging characteristics. But I think in the end, he was both very deep and very serious in the sense of focusing his attention on what he thought would be best for the people of our country. And he really... he taught me that politics isn't ultimately about, you know, parties and manoeuvring and, you know, who gets what job and who's up and who's down and, you know, all those sorts of things, and tribal loyalties and whatnot. But rather, it's about a discussion between different ideas and trying to work out which ideas are likely to produce the policies that are most likely to bring advantage to, you know, humanity as a whole and our fraction of humanity in particular. And that's actually somehow in the end much more important than all the other things you might learn from someone when you're setting out in politics.
Yes, and you, I think in the book you describe it as he saw politics as a search for truth. And truth is something that is a word that crops up quite a lot in the book, which struck me as actually quite an unusual thing for a politician to sort of see his job as having something to do with. I mean, in terms of the popular idea of politicians, the truth would be something that would be something that troublesome journalists would present to them and they'd have to come up with an answer to. So where do you think you get this idea of sort of searching for the truth being a sort of politician's job?
Well, and the first thing I should say in Sydney is something about journalism, which is that with some rare exceptions, I think actually interest in the truth in the sense of the real truth is something that's almost deserted our media. Actually, unpopular as this statement will be in many sections of the Conservative Party, the BBC is in most respects sort of more interested in and answerable to the truth than most of the rest of the media, and in fact the other broadcasters, compared to the newspapers. I think the newspapers are the main villains here. But actually, the story is what dominates, even for the broadcasters, and much more so for the newspapers. The story is what dominates rather than the truth. And so this sort of charade of exposing the truth actually is really about generating the story.
Mm-hmm.
But what gets in the way of the truth for politicians is something different. It's not the story and the need to sell papers or get audiences. It's tribalism. It's being swept up in the argument. And I'm a believer in democracy. I don't think it's just sort of the least worst system. I think it's actually a good system. But I think it's only a good system if it's conducted in a way that means that people of opposing views are doing so in the spirit of acknowledging the truth as they see it. Now, they're going to take different views of many things, and the truth is not a thing that's seen by all people in the same way, obviously. That's the point of the debate, just as there's a point in debates between people of differing views about science. You know, that's how science makes progress. Politics in a democracy makes progress if people take differing views, but only if they're actually willing to admit the strength of their opponent's arguments where they see it. If people engage in democratic debate on the basis of just assuming that if the opponent says it, it's false, and therefore can be ignored, we don't get anywhere. We just produce populism and not a serious liberal democracy. So I think truth is absolutely at the centre of these things. And actually, as I say, most of the time, when they're not engaged in, you know, theatre-like Prime Minister's questions, but are engaged in serious discussion, politicians are interested in that and do recognise the force of each other's views. And that's why politicians cross the floor and why politicians actually recognise the merits of people on other sides of the House of Commons or any other legislature and so on, in a way that many people find surprising.
So do you worry then that in 2017 we're getting further away from this ideal you sort of present, that things are sort of calcifying? And
I don't think that politics is getting further away from it, no. I think, as I say, the media has diverged from it a lot. There is a strain of politics always around that denies all that and that is just engaged in populist demagoguery. Mm. And I think you see that in some of the far right, far left politics around the place. The whole point about fanatics is that they don't engage with the arguments of their opponents because they just regard their opponents as evil and that's the end of the matter.
And then the sort of conservative equivalent of that over the last, well, throughout your career really, you talk very critically and interestingly, I thought, about this concept of soundness and how in Margaret Thatcher's years it was being one of us and later it was, is X or Y politician sound on a given subject? And these ideas kind of inhibit free conversation that you...
Yes, I think that's right. I think tribalism has many aspects, but one aspect is the sort of peer group that creates an atmosphere in which you are one of us, you are not, you are sound, mm-hmm. or not. Whereas in fact, every democratic political party is bound to be, is rightly, a coalition of people of differing views on many subjects who, for one reason or another, have more in common than they have with other potential groupings. But that doesn't mean they're going to feel identically about everything. And what benefits a party and benefits a government and benefits a country is if people continue to explore those differences and work out where each of them has something to say. Of course, there are people around in the world who are either lunatic or stupid or malign, but there aren't very many people who are either lunatic or stupid or malign. Most people in any domain, and certainly most people in politics, are intelligent and benevolent and sane. And so it's to be expected that from their varying different points of view, they will have something to say. There'll be some part of the truth that they're seeing. And so they need to be taken into the conversation and not dismissed on the grounds that they're not one of us.
Let's go back to your time working for Margaret Thatcher. You worked in the policy unit in Downing Street. And you were unusually well prepared in many ways because some of the great thinkers that influenced Thatcherism were people who you had known as a child when you were growing up. Maybe tell us about that.
Yes,
no,
I tried to bring that out in the book. People like Hayek and Popper and Oakeshott and Friedman and Banfield and others were in and out. That was very exciting intellectually, but also sort of helped me later to understand the background to what became Thatcherism.
you actually say, you actually also say in the book that you felt physically sick with excitement when you first opened the Open Society. So so politics is very much an ideas first thing for you rather than...
Yes, yes, it is. Anybody who's ever had the experience of reading anything, I mentioned some other books that had the same sort of effect on me in other domains. But, I mean, anybody's had the experience of reading something that's a really exciting book knows that, like with a great piece of music or an extraordinarily beautiful painting or building or sunset over Sunion or a love affair, there are various things in human life that can enlarge the spirit and that are unforgettable and formative. And for me, certainly, that does not consist of the sort of day-to-day business of sort of, you know, numbers of votes accumulated on particular bills or what the Times newspaper is calling today's story or something of that sort. It consists of the ideas that lie underneath politics and that illuminate politics and that, in the end, determine the fates of nations and continents and of humanity.
And what was it about Popper in particular that you found so exciting?
Oh, it's just, I mean, I'm not by any means an undiluted admirer of Popper's, as will become evident from the book, but there are other philosophers that I treasure much more highly than him. But what's exciting about it is the extraordinary clarity with which he reveals the difference between liberalism and a series of very enticing theories from Plato to Marx, which are about closed societies, as he calls it. And I think it is, in the end, it's the triumph of Western liberal democracy is above all the triumph of an open society.
And that was, at least you argue in the book, the success of Thatcherism was its ability to take these ideas and marry them with a very pragmatic and practical approach to government and an emphasis on ultimately policies that actually worked,
yes,
rather than any commitment to a abstract ideology. So why do you think it has this reputation for being very much ideologically driven rather than...
Well, to be driven by an idea or a series of coherent ideas is very different from thinking that you thereby obtain some blueprint which you should think you can improve humanity by imposing and just working to in ignorance of the facts and the histories and the complexities of human society. One of the points about conservatism is that it acknowledges that things aren't like that. There aren't rationalist blueprints that give you simple answers that you just sort of turn on by flicking switches. What I think made the period that Mrs. Thatcher was Prime Minister so remarkable was that it was driving in a certain direction, governed by a conception of an idea, an aim, to liberate the energies of the nation, by liberating people to do what Michael Gove rather beautifully describes as writing their own life stories more. But it did that in a very down-to-earth, practical, pragmatic way. And it, as you say, it tried to find solutions that actually worked. And that, of course, the test of the idea in the end is not, is it a nice idea, but does it produce a better life for humanity? I would strongly argue that history shows that, in the end, free markets informed by social justice produce a better life for humanity than any other system of government.
But you do, and this is a theme throughout the book, you admit that there was a blind spot, really, for Thatcherism and for the people working for Mrs. Thatcher, which is whether these ideas necessarily worked for those at the very bottom of...
Yes, and that's where I think Keith came in. That the reason that Keith is, in a way, the sort of presiding hero of the first half of this book is that he was trying to get the rest of us to recognize what the rest of us didn't sufficiently recognize, which is that the informed by social justice bit of the free markets informed by social justice is just as important as the free market bit of it. Both matter equally. And we didn't we knew that social justice mattered, but we didn't pay as much attention to it in those days, I think, as we needed to, or as Keith wanted us to. In the book, I also tried to bring out that there was another thing we didn't pay sufficient attention to, although Mrs. Thatcher herself did pay enough attention to it. But in the period just after Mrs. Thatcher, the Conservative Party, including those who thought themselves as Thatcherites, didn't pay enough attention to it, and that was the other side to this, which is not just social justice but the environment. Because what we need for humanity is the prosperity that enables you to live well and to fund good public services and so on. The social justice that allows the people who are at the bottom of the heap, whom the market is not properly serving, to be looked after properly by the rest of society, and a concern of the whole with the environment we live in, so that we live not just in a rich and just society, but in a beautiful world.
And why do you think it was that you missed, so many of you missed that point about the social justice side of it?
Well, what I try and explain in the book is I think it was a combination of things, partly because of the battles that were having to be fought against a rather Neolithic socialism that had impoverished Britain dramatically and had made life worse for almost everyone. And it's sort of difficult to fight that battle on behalf of the free market while sufficiently emphasising the point that many of the socialists actually were making, which is a true point, that you also needed to concern yourself with those who were least well off. But partly also, I think, what we were talking about a little while back, the sort of sense of them and us, of being one of us, of soundness and so on, got in the way. People were afraid, not Keith, certainly, not some others, but mainly people were afraid to dwell too much on social justice in case they were accused of not sufficiently signing on to the free market agenda, whereas I see the two, in fact, and I think Keith saw them as two sides of the same coin, and that we should have recognised more than we did.
And it's funny because I think even now people reading you making that point might be surprised to then hear the next point being that it was Keith Joseph that did realise this, in that in the kind of memory of Thatcherism, your argument would be seen to be sort of a point in favour of the so-called wets and the other side of the Conservative Party.
Yes,
whereas Joseph was a sort of Thatcherite before Thatcher was.
That's true. But of course, in this, he was on the side of the wets.
Mm-hmm.
The problem about the wets was that they didn't, at the beginning, sufficiently acknowledge the importance of the free market side of the equation. They came to, actually. And we, as a Conservative Party, of course, came to recognise the social justice side of the question. So this book is also an optimistic book in the sense that it suggests that the party as a whole gradually came to understand this balance in the right kind of way.
Well, and later in the book you describe the time after the 97 election, and you're by then an MP, and you have this blank document on your computer screen. I think it just says at the top, what is the present purpose of the Conservative Party? And you find yourself staring at this document for quite some time before you know how to fill it out.
Yes, years. Mm.
And what was it that sort of made you realise what the party was for? I mean,
well, I can't say that I realised it. I think the party gradually realised it, and I saw it happening and came to see how some people were right about it. I think the problem in 97 was acute because Tony Blair had essentially bought into the entire Thatcherite thesis so far as the management of the economy was concerned. And he kept on doing things which actually we all agreed with. And so that leads you to the question, well, why do you need a Conservative Party if the Labour Party is being run by somebody who's doing things Conservatives agree with? Gradually, of course, the Blair government started doing some things we didn't agree with. That created one kind of purpose. For example, they started spending too much money that the nation didn't have, whereas Mrs. Thatcher had gone around the country in 1979 endlessly saying, you can't spend money you haven't got. So the Labour Party, under Gordon Brown rather than Tony Blair, sort of lost sight of that. But the other thing that happened was that the Conservative Party rediscovered social justice and the environment as crucial components of the package, so to speak. And that had a lot to do with Ian Duncan Smith and his recognition of social justice and the moves that we then made in the transition between him and Michael Howard and in the transition between Michael Howard and David Cameron and in David Cameron's leadership to recognize the fundamental role of the environment too. So these things corrected themselves. It isn't that I suddenly had an inspiration. It's that the party as a whole moved in a certain and very constructive direction.
The social justice side of things, I think, is a common cause among the party, parliamentary Conservative Party. The environmental side of things has become a very contentious, climate change in particular has become a very contentious issue. You describe your work making a Conservative case for action on it. Are you surprised in the way that debate goes on in 2017? I mean, would you have been surprised?
Well, I think, first of all, you have to distinguish between different things. I think actually there's a very, very strong and generalized support in the Conservative Party, right across the Parliamentary Party and the Voluntary Party and so on, in favor of concern with the environment. Actually, whether it's forests or the Blue Belt, the preservation of the seas and the biodiversity in them, or the efforts to preserve tigers and the like in against extinction, or the need to beautify our cities and preserve the beauty of our rural landscape, or the importance of built heritage, or the necessity for clean air, or I could go on and on about things actually that the Conservative Party, not only the Conservative Party at all, of course, by any means, but the Conservative Party as a whole signs on to a big environmental agenda with hardly any debate whatsoever. Of course, there may be debates about specific elements of it or means to achieve it, but the broad thrust is unified. The one area where it's been contentious is this question of the extent of anthropogenic climate change and the degree to which, therefore, A, the world as a whole, and B, the UK, should have its energy policy orientated towards reducing carbon emissions. This is a very highly technical issue. I don't think there's any doubt at all in the minds of any Conservative Member of Parliament or any Conservative activist that if it is true that the world as a whole is going to be adversely affected by climate change, and if it is true that, as I believe it is, that anthropogenic climate change poses a risk to the world, therefore, that we should take some steps to avoid the risk. I think the main issue actually has been about whether the UK alone can significantly alter that, and whether we should accept the costs of a switch to lower carbon forms of energy production when the UK's contribution to the problem is so small by comparison with the rest of the world.
There is also a dividing line between you and some of your colleagues about, you know, whether it's something that is worth taking any action on whatsoever.
I think very, very few actually. I don't think there are very many people in the Conservative Party at all who would argue that it's not worth having an insurance policy against at least the possibility that anthropogenic climate change will cause significant difficulties. I think most of the issue has actually been about the degree of certainty attached to those projections. And incidentally, I don't feel any certainty about them. They're scientific projections. Since when has one ever had certainty about scientific projections? The problem is that there's a risk. And I think most people would agree that there is a risk. So the next question is, does Britain, by taking certain steps in the Climate Change Act, of which I was a strong supporter and one of the originators, does Britain, by remorselessly reducing the carbon content of its energy systems, for example, and its transport systems, does it actually make a difference, or are we just imposing on ourselves a set of costs which other countries can avoid? I think the reason we come a long way on this is that actually the world has moved on a lot, and other countries too are taking these steps. So it's becoming less contentious, I think. But the other thing that's happened is that the economics have changed.
Mm-hmm.
And as I've always suspected would be the case, actually the technologies which produce lower carbon forms of energy and transport are actually beginning to be economically superior. I don't think there is this great tension between our economic advantage and our environmental concerns. There are costs involved, but there are also benefits. And therefore, I think actually progressively this argument is disappearing and we're coming to a consensus, which is a good thing.
To take something I think your colleagues, on a completely different subject, your colleagues would all agree on, which is privatisation, one of the big landmark policies of the Thatcher years, and something which I think you then consulted other governments on implementing. What was that like? Was that, from your point of view, was that...
Well, advising on privatisations around the world was a very, very interesting phase of my life. From my point of view, of course, principally of interest because of seeing how other countries work and how their bureaucracies and their politics work. A fascinating and really instructive period for me. I do believe that we did also do some considerable good. I mean, I think the discovery that it was possible to achieve the goals that people had in mind when they nationalized things around the world, instead by regulating things properly so that to the maximum possible extent quality was driven up and prices driven down by competition, and where that wasn't possible, that prices were driven down and quality driven up by regulatory intervention. That discovery that you could, the government could act as a promoter of competition and as a regulator and therefore didn't need to be an owner, and the discovery that if government wasn't an owner, private sector capital and private sector market disciplines could produce better results than on the whole, on average, isn't universal truth, but on average, than over a long haul nationalized industries were capable of producing, was, I think, a discovery of great value to the world. And I certainly found myself in having a very interesting time advising governments like the Cuban government, which is not natural.
That was one of the more surprising sentences in the book.
It wasn't just them either. I mean, there were large numbers of socialist states which privatized very considerable amount. It's a very interesting and important observation that the 19th Congress of the Communist Party of China has recently been held, and the President Xi's banner was socialism with Chinese characteristics. Well, it turns out that socialism with Chinese characteristics involves probably the most vibrant free market that there is in the world. That is a long way from things which happened in the past, and I think the bringing of hundreds of millions of people in China from poverty into prosperity by a series of much more enlightened Chinese regimes has been a huge success story for humanity.
And when we look at these that success story, or as you say, this evident success of privatization here and in other countries, why do you think it is that when you come back to the attitudes of British voters today, these ideas aren't, that the market is not seen particularly favorably, and that privatization is something that as many people sort of regret as are thankful for? And
well, I think what happens is that people come to take for granted things which exist, forget, or don't read the history enough to know what went before and what effects it had. And I suppose that's entirely natural. But in the end, the sad paradox of nationalisation in Britain is that it didn't achieve the noble aims that its proponents had for it. They wanted the best. They wanted good quality at low prices to provide electricity and transport and housing and many other things for the people. These are admirable aims. It didn't work. And I just hope that people don't have to experience that all over again to learn all over again that actually it isn't the best way of organizing things.
Is it a surprise to you, though, that these things are, these battles you were part of winning in the 80s are being refought now? Or do you think that's just the nature of things?
I think it's the nature of things that these issues go on being debated, because the truth is that they're complex. And there are deficiencies. Of course, there are deficiencies with markets, and there are deficiencies, even more deficiencies, with private monopolies. And it's difficult to regulate and to achieve really effective regulation of private monopolies. And it's difficult to maintain sobriety and proper behavior in open markets, and people see these difficulties. And of course, it's also the case that it's easy to see the unattractive side of people becoming very wealthy and then, you know, not paying as much tax as they're due to pay or something of that sort. And it's very understandable that people feel very strong resentments about this, both the intrinsic difficulty of operating an economy and the natural resentments of people about bad behavior continually recreate the circumstances under which somebody will, for populist reasons, argue that the answers are simple and that if we just nationalized everything and taxed everybody to the hilt, all would be well. We have to remake the argument because the basis for the argument is always there. But I think if we make the argument properly, we can persuade people, because there is a truth here, and the truth is that actually, for all its imperfections, a free market economy informed by social justice does better by the people as a whole, including those at the bottom of the heap and those in the middle, as well as those at the top, than other systems have.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
That system that you say is the one that works the best. I mean, you sort of finally arrived in government in 2010, and you were working with some Liberal Democrats who, in the book, you're very you're very generous in the things you say about them, and you actually say that you had more in common with some of them than you had with lots of your conservative colleagues. So that was your sort of chance to put these ideas into practice. And what do you, when you look back on that now, what do you see as the big achievements of that, the coalition?
Well, I think that coalition government did a remarkably good job. I think it took the nation through a very, very difficult patch in its history. I think the effects of the 2008 crash were much more profound than was recognized at the time. I think we're still learning how profound and long-dated those effects are, not just in the UK, but in the Western world as a whole. Because of the excessive expenditures of Gordon Brown and his colleagues leading up to 2008, the nation was ill-prepared to deal with that financial and fiscal shock. And we were very badly placed economically at that time. And the coalition government, under George Osborne's chancellorship, steered a path through many minefields. A lot of people said that the path he chose was going to lead to disaster. It didn't. It led to success. The deficit was brought back to tolerable proportions without creating any significant growth in unemployment. In fact, through most of the later years, with sharply rising employment, partly because of changes in welfare policy which went with it. In addition to rescuing the fiscal position and keeping up employment and reducing unemployment, that government introduced strong elements of the beginnings of a successful industrial strategy, for example, the automotive strategy.
It introduced a massive boost to training in this country with the revivification of the apprenticeship system. It dramatically improved our schools. It had a much less successful start on health and social care, but I think it gradually came to understand what was needed by way of integration of health and social care and began that work.
And in the coalition government, you're given this job of basically, for a long period of it, that's incredibly wide-ranging, and one minute you're, a big part of it is sort of keeping the Lib Dems on side of lots of different things. But in terms of the policy areas you're dealing with, it's an incredibly broad set of things. I mean, how did you find that? I mean, was that something?
Well, it was endlessly fascinating. I was very, very lucky to be able to sort of write my own job spec. It was a project that I was very fully committed to, and I was working with David Cameron and George Osborne, who were close political allies and friends, and with Liberal Democrats who proved to be congenial partners. So it was entirely doable. It was only when I stopped doing it in 2016, not by choice, but by being removed, that I suddenly realised how immensely strenuous it had been, and what an intense relief it was to be freed of the cares of office.
But you're going to be busy again soon. You've got your planning review that you're in charge of for the Chancellor. Well, that would be less strenuous, do you think?
All the things that I'm doing now are entirely different order of magnitude of strain. People often don't realise how strenuous ministerial life is these days, and I think mine was particularly so because I was kind of the minister for negotiation and minister for crisis. Mm-hmm. And there was always some negotiation or some crisis going on and ones to come. So it was really from very early in the morning till very late at night, 7 days a week, and including wandering around floods on Christmas Day.
Yes, you're getting stressed
as I think about it, I recall the extraordinary and intense pressure. But I mean, what keeps you going, of course, is just, it's a great privilege to do it. It's, if you're interested in politics and in making ideas come into reality in government, it is completely fascinating. So the adrenaline and the interest and the sort of passion for it make it tremendous fun. I don't mean in any way to suggest that I didn't enjoy it while I was doing it. I did hugely. But actually, as I say, nothing else you could do really comes anywhere near to the level of strain of that.
Do you think that's a problem in terms of the quality of government we get? I think in Gordon Brown's new memoirs, he complains about how the sort of Victorian prime ministers had much more time to indulge various other interests they had and were markedly less stressed and overworked, and their life wasn't so public as politicians today, and so on.
Oh well, there is, of course, there's that side to it, and of course, prime ministers have a whole different dimension, which makes it much more strenuous than anything I was doing. Being prime minister is vastly more strenuous than any ministerial post, because you're also the centre of attention, and you are the representative of the country, and you're making extraordinarily difficult decisions. You literally, as prime minister, you're never asked to make a decision unless it's completely unobvious what the answer is, because if it's obvious what the answer is, somebody else will have made the decision. So it's incredibly difficult to be prime minister. And that certainly has changed over time in the sense that the amount of things that governments do and hence the amount of things that a prime minister is responsible for have vastly increased compared to the past. And that is an issue. Of course, it's an enormous issue. I don't think for ministers who are engaged sort of way below the level of the prime minister in, and all ministers are way below the level of the prime minister, in sort of the nuts and bolts of government, and I was very much the nuts and bolts of government, are much more strenuously engaged than they would ever have been. It is getting the nuts and bolts right is a jolly strenuous activity, and I think it's just bound to be that way. It's just a very very large machine and you're trying to deal with a large number of problems at all times.
And then the thing that brings the administration you're at the centre of to an end is obviously the referendum in 2016. You open your book actually with description of the European issue, and you find yourself in an odd position because you wrote in 1987 a CPS pamphlet that at the time was seen to be sort of screechingly Eurosceptic, and then in the intervening years you sort of your views more or less stayed the same and everyone went from one side of you to the other on the European question. Why did you sort of stay so firm to that?
Well,
I mean, maybe perhaps just explain what your
I think
of...
I mean the point for me was that I regarded and still regard the free trade side of the EU, the customs union, the single market, as hugely attractive and advantageous. What I regarded as not attractive, not advantageous, was the ambition of some within the many, the prevailing tendency within the EU to become more like a federal state with its own system of law, its own army, its own armed forces, its own foreign policy, its own trade policy, its own currency, its own tax policy, and so on. I mean, these are the things that are formative of a state, and it was clearly gradually trying to become one. That I found unattractive. So for me, from an early stage, I mean, relative to British politics, an early stage, sort of, as you say, about 1987, so 30 years ago, the issue had always been how do we continue to engage in the benefits of the single market and the customs union without getting dragged into this European superstate? One part of that, of course, was not to be part of the euro. Another part would have been, and this would have solved all the problems, actually, I think, not to have allowed the Maastricht Treaty and its successors in Amsterdam and Lisbon and so on to occur. Had we never lost the veto, it would never have been possible to create a European superstate. That was where the wrong turning was taken. But even then, by staying out of the euro and maintaining some distance, therefore, from absorption into the currency, which was the foundation stone of also a centralized, emerging centralized taxation policy, we stood, it seemed to me, some chance of achieving this status of being part of a sort of outer circle, while an inner circle gradually became more and more like a state. I kept on hoping that we could foster that arrangement, and I believed that the deal that we'd struck at the end of David Cameron's time in office did offer that prospect. Wasn't overnight going to create the two, the outer circle and the inner core, but I think it would have led progressively to that answer, and so I was very sad that it wasn't given a chance because we decided instead simply as a nation to leave altogether, which has certain advantages and certain disadvantages. But it was a very odd experience listening to the Leave and the Remain campaigns because I thought both were way off beam. I don't think anything like the universal bliss that some of the Leave campaigners thought was going to be engendered by leaving is going to be engendered by leaving, and I didn't think that anything like the doom and disaster that some of the Remain campaigners asserted was going to be the result of the result of leaving was going to be generated by leaving. And I think the truth is that it's a rather balanced issue whether one should remain or not remain. While I think the nation probably made the wrong decision on that, I think now the thing is to sort of get on and do it and make it as smooth as possible and end up therefore by being able to take advantage of the advantages without too many of the disadvantages.
Given that you see it as a fairly balanced issue, and you know, actually, when you describe your thinking behind it, one of the striking things to me is the difference in terms of whether someone with your broad view of the EU, which I'd say is typical of your party, it's only it hangs on a few small things, basically. I mean, it hangs on whether this two-speed Europe was possible, whether the negotiation was genuinely did offer that. Given that it comes down to these narrow things, are you surprised by the sort of nature of the debate since the referendum and quite how, again, there's been a sort of that one of us, one of them sort of approach to things?
I think, I mean, it's always regrettable when people sort of get into camps and throw missiles. Actually, within the parliamentary party, I don't think it has been like that. I'm very struck by the good humour and the mutual tolerance and the acceptance of differences of opinion within the parliamentary party since the vote. And as we've gone through the whole legislative process, for example, so people have been trying to deal with the legislation in a very grown-up kind of way. And some of us who were strong Brexiteers, some who were strong Remainers, some like me, sort of much more balanced and in the middle, have joined forces to try to improve legislation and support it as it goes through. So my sense is actually that at the level of politics and politicians mainly, there hasn't been the sort of tribalism which you're referring to. I think what's regrettable is that outside Parliament, there has been the stirring of these sorts of emotions. I think it will take some while for quite a large, not probably an enormous number, but nevertheless quite a large number of people in our country to sort of reacquire an equilibrium.
And are you any more or less optimistic or pessimistic about our prospects outside of the EU today as you were when, you know, the morning of after the referendum?
No, I because I never shared the euphoria of the leavers nor the massive despondency of the remainers. When I say the leavers and remainers, I mean the more extreme variants.
Of course, yeah.
I'm not at all surprised that my current view remains that leaving will probably, on balance, be disadvantageous, but not hugely disadvantageous. And it will certainly have some advantages. And I think things are sort of, as I would have expected, pretty, you know, pretty difficult to negotiate. I'm personally not very convinced that there will be a free trade agreement with the EU. I think this country is perfectly capable of conducting its affairs without such a free trade agreement. It did for many years. I can't see any reason why it shouldn't in the future. And I think actually that our main attention should now be devoted to getting the legislation in place and putting in place all the administrative arrangements that would be necessary if we don't have a free trade agreement, so that it can operate relatively smoothly, and so that also we maximise the chances of getting an acceptable free trade agreement, because I think we'll only do that if we can show that actually we have a decent alternative, which is to leave without such an agreement.
And is it moments like this that you regret that you're not there? You know, you describe yourself in the nuts and bolts of government, and do you sit on the back benches thinking, I wish I were there?
Oh, no, very much the opposite. I can't tell you how lucky personally I feel not to be having to wrestle with these incredibly difficult things that now face the government. No, it's a delight to be able to think about these things calmly and to talk about them in Parliament legislatively and so on, and leave the really hard work of negotiation and of preparation for leaving to colleagues that are doing noble work with great difficulty.
And moving on from Brexit, you, at the end of your book, you sort of asked, you consider the question of whether Brexit, the election of Donald Trump in America, populist movements in Europe and so on, whether this, you know, how without precedent and how significant historically all of this is, and you sort of come to the conclusion that this is not a reason to think that you've got to throw the kind of handbook out the window, and that really this is about the crash in many ways, and the tail of the crash is much longer than we perhaps realised.
Yes, absolutely. That is exactly what I think. And I think the fact that people's real living standards, you know, will take a long time to rise above where they were in 2008, not just in the UK but around the Western world, is a very serious issue. It's serious enough for people that have above the median income. It's much more serious for people that are at or below the median income. And it's been tough. And of course, that generates all sorts of reactions. Some of them being far right populist reactions, some far left populist reactions. It differs in different countries, but it's the same phenomenon, essentially, in my view. And I think the right answer for those who believe in liberal democracy as a whole, and within that, in free markets informed by social justice, is to hold our nerve and make the arguments. And I think in the end, I'm optimistic that people will vote for parties that actually offer the real prospect of a better society and a better economy, rather than parties that offer ostensibly more radical solutions, which are in fact not going to work.
And why didn't the Conservatives didn't make the recent the 2017 election? There wasn't this. That case was not made.
Oh, don't let's talk about the 2017 election. I think the Conservative election campaign in the 2017 general election was a total disaster. But we're not going to do that again. You only do that once.
But on the particular point of, say, the attitude to the market, I mean, there was the line about rejecting the libertarian right and the left and so on. Do you think that was a tactical mistake, or do you think that's genuinely sort of the mindset of the leadership?
I prefer to think forward. I think in 2022, when we come to fight the next general election, the party will want to do what the party needs to do, which is to make afresh the argument for free markets, informed by social justice and by concern for our environment. And we're going to need to make the argument that free market approach, as well as concerning itself with redistribution and the environment, actually can alone produce the prosperity that allows you to redistribute the money to those who need it most in society and to preserve excellent public services. And by making those arguments, we take seriously and take on and can then, I think, defeat the left-wing populism of the Corbynites. And maybe, again, persuade the Labour Party or persuade people in the Labour Party to go back to a much more rational, Blairite form of Labour politics, which may in the long run incidentally be less good for conservative electoral prospects, but much better for our country. One used to be able to say that it didn't terribly matter whether Labour was in or the Conservatives were in, because whether it was Blair or Cameron, shall we say, you were going to get a government that was sane and broadly heading in the same direction with some changes of emphasis. And we need to get back to that. That's what's in the interest of our country. And I think if we hold our nerve, we will get back to that. And I think in 2022, we will do that. One of the things that went wrong before and plagued us in 17 was not taking Mr. Corbyn seriously and not making the argument. I think we've learned that lesson, and we'll now make the argument.
Oliver Lowen, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned, We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.